their time, their audience, and their theme. So help me to fill them out. Obadiah, audience. Edom, lost cry for mercy. Joel, the great and terrible day of the Lord. Jonah, Nineveh, it's just like His great love. Doesn't it make you mad? Amos, Israel, a little bit out of plumb. Always remember the wall. They thought they were plumb. We all think we're plumb, but we're really a little out of plumb. Hosea, Israel, unfailing love, the unfailing love of God. Unbelievable. Now we're going to be talking about Isaiah, from Isaiah, Micah, Nahum tonight. And Isaiah is to who? Judah. And the name, Jehovah saves, or the salvation of Jehovah, or the salvation of the Lord. Micah, two cities. No, Jerusalem, and Jerusalem's the capital of the southern two tribes, and what's the capital? Samaria is the capital of the northern ten tribes. So he's going to talk to both nations, but he's going to talk to their capitals. And the theme is, who is a pardoning God like thee? Micah chapter 7, verse 18. Then Nahum, and you see a big jump on time there. You see that? Hosea, Isaiah, or actually Amos, Jonah, all those 760 to 710, they're all kind of, you're kind of fighting the same time there. But then we make a big jump, and we think it's about 660. We'll talk about that later. The audience is Nineveh again, although he doesn't talk to Nineveh. He's going to talk to Judah. So there's a sense in which the real audience is Judah, but he's talking about Nineveh to Judah. So we always say Nineveh. He says nothing about Israel or about Judah. He just talks about Nineveh the whole time. The theme is reaping the whirlwind, and we'll fill in the rest. I also introduced you to the seven laws of the teacher. And the first law is the law of the teacher. You got to know the material. You can't teach what you don't know. Can't no more teach what you don't know than you can come from where you ain't been. And so we talked about that. You got to know the material. If you're going to, the law of the student says you have to keep their attention. And a learner is one who attends with interest to the lesson, or if they ain't listening, they ain't learning, you know? And that's a real important truth. So that really helped me out. You got to, it's not enough to, it's not, when you're talking, you're not teaching. I had to learn that. Even if everything you say is right on, if nobody's listening, you weren't teaching a thing. You know, talking is not teaching. And so you got to interact with the people. Somehow you got to keep them, their attention. And so that's, you got to keep their attention, and that's not easy. You got to start out, you got to grab their attention, and you can't let go of it the whole time. And once you lose it, boy, you got to really work hard to get it back. The law of the language is the third one. You got to speak their language, not the language or their language. All right. The language used as medium between the teacher and the learner must be common to both. In other words, it's all Greek to me. All right. Doesn't help you at all if I'm saying all kinds of truth, but I'm using words you don't know. And you all have been in situations where a teacher is, he's saying great things. I was with my son the other day. He's a doctor, and he's telling me all about whatever. And it's like, doesn't mean a thing to me, buddy. I don't know what a tibia is. I don't have a clue what those things are, you know. So he thinks I know all those words. So you got to speak their language. Or the old statement was K-I-S-S. Keep it simple, stupid. Or one of the classic ones in seminary we were taught, put the cookies on the second on the bottom shelf. Let them get it. Don't think you have to impress people with your brilliant words and wow them with how smart you are. Put the cookies on the bottom shelf, let everybody get them, and probably they still won't get it. But try as hard as you can to speak their language. We're going to look at the other ones. Those will help you maybe a little bit. They sure have helped me. KKSSGR has helped me a lot. Tonight we're going to be looking at Isaiah and then Micah. And then Nahum, and hopefully God will help us through that. You got to love Isaiah, but I've never dared to preach through it. I'm about ready to, maybe, now that I'm old enough. I don't know. I've been thinking about starting the series on Isaiah soon. And I've preached a lot of passages of it, but it's a tremendous book, right? It's called the Bible in miniature, by the way. And why would it be called the Bible in miniature? All right, so it breaks up the same way. The Old Testament has 39 books. The New Testament has 27. Isaiah, almost everybody will break it up, 39 chapters, 27 chapters. And so they will do that. There's a little bit of a danger if you do that. I'll just warn you about that, saying it's the Bible in miniature. And that is because there's a little bit of a thinking that the Old Testament is about judgment and the New Testament about love. And when you study the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, he's going to be talking about condemnation. And the last 27 chapters, he's going to talk about comfort. So although I don't mind it if we say it's the Bible in miniature, I'm a little hesitant to say, you know, the God of the Old Testament is a God of condemnation, the God of the New Testament is a God of comfort, because I don't believe that at all. He's the same God all the way through. And for all the condemnation of the Old Testament, he sure gave a lot of comfort. And for all the comfort in the New Testament, he sure gave much condemnation. But that's what people would say, and that's their reasoning for that. The author, of course, is Isaiah, and there's the Hebrew kind of spelling of it if you want to see that. And it means Yahweh or Jehovah is salvation, or Jehovah saves, or salvation is of the Lord, or you've got to love Hebrew. It's a very simple language in many ways, and it doesn't have a lot of the verbs and things that we have. So you can, you know, if you had three people translate a word, it all sounds different. You say, well, what is it? Is it Jehovah saves, or Jehovah is salvation, or salvation is of the Lord? To us, those are three different sentences. They just have one word that says it all, and they can kind of understand that. He's uncompromising. He's sincere. He's noted for that. He's sincere. He's noted for that. And yet he's compassionate. And when we get to Isaiah 6 in a little while, we'll see why he did it. He's called the Shakespeare of the prophets. He's called the Paul of the Old Testament. And most people consider him one of the great, great prophets. They're all great prophets, but one of the great ones. One of the great issues for those who study the book is, was it written by two authors? Now, probably isn't an issue to you. In some ways you say, why we even talk about that? But it is an issue. And a lot of commentaries that you read will just talk as if that's a fact. I mean, just, you know, keep going. And they don't even question it, because in scholarly circles, it has been so drilled into them that there are two authors that they believe it. It's just like evolutionists believe it's evolution. They don't even doubt it. And the reason for that is here. Chapter 1 through 39, the first Isaiah wrote that one. It has an Assyrian background. It's terse. It's rational. It's very condemning. And all of a sudden in chapter 40, it's like a whole new guy steps on the scene. And so they call that the second Isaiah. And all of a sudden they would say that it has to do with after the Babylonian captivity. That it's flowing, it's emotional, and it's full of comfort. Personally, to me, it doesn't have to be that. I mean, there is a definite change. There's hardly anybody in the world who's read Isaiah doesn't see there's a shift there. It doesn't mean it's two people. It doesn't mean one was written during the Assyrian captivity and one was written after the Babylonian. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means the message keeps going, and we're going to see how that all fits together. But you have to know that. The answer, I think, is John 12, verse 37. Christ quotes from Isaiah as if he was indeed the author of the whole shmear, okay? And most of us who believe in the inspiration of Scripture don't have a problem with one author. It was Isaiah. That's it. But you just have to be aware that there's a lot of people. And they're not all that liberal, some of them. Some of them have been so influenced by it that after a while they actually believe that there were two authors of Isaiah, the condemning guy and the comforting guy. And actually it's the same God who wrote it. The audience, of course, is Judah and Jeremiah. Okay, and that's an interesting thing. And I'm sorry, yeah, Jeremiah. The times, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah are the kings. If you read in chapter 1, it is not Jeremiah, it's Jerusalem. Why did I write down Jeremiah there? Okay, change that. Jerusalem. So he's going to the capital of the southern tribe of Judah in chapter 1, verse 1, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So it's all about Judah. Now, what do you know about those kings? I have the dates there. Uzziah from 767 to about 739, then Jotham from 739 to 731, et cetera, et cetera. What did we talk about in Amos and some of the other ones? In some ways, okay. Not necessarily. Hezekiah will come right back. It's kind of, Uzziah was the best of the best as far as Judah. He was the golden era. But then at the end, remember, he does a dastardly deed, and God is going to punish him, gives him leprosy, and he pleads to God, and God said, I'll give you 10 more years, and he did. But it's the golden era of Israel. And he was a great king, did a kind of a dumb thing when he tried to sacrifice what a priest was supposed to do. In the end, God had to deal with that, but he came right back, and that was okay. Jotham was basically a good king and carried on. He was only there 8 years, but he carried on what his father had done. Ahaz is a terrible king. He's not Ahab, who is even worse, but Ahaz is a bad boy. He's a corrupt. He does evil. And then Hezekiah comes right back, and you remember the great reforms and revivals of Hezekiah. So we have all that going on. But if you put that together, you probably can say it's between 740 and 680 B.C. And we know that Isaiah preached a long time, so it might have been those dates that I just gave you, 60 years. It might not have been that long. It might have been 40 years. It might have been 45 years. Who knows? We're not sure of that. But we're going to find in chapter 6, verse 1, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. So it probably started the year of his death, which is about 740 or 739 B.C. Remember, that was the end of the golden era. The whole world came crashing down. It's like, you know, whoever our greatest president was who had led us through all kinds of great, great things, and the day he dies, you're like, how are we going to go on? So it was a very traumatic time. It was during the last days in the fall of the nation of Israel. If you put, remember the fall of Israel was in what day? Israel fell to the Assyrians in 722, all right? So if he started in 740, Israel has about 18 years left, and so he kind of is preaching to Judah and Jerusalem while Israel is going through their last days, and they're going to fall while he's a preacher. And that usually has impact on the southern tribes, even though they are not part of the Israel. He's a contemporary of Jonah and Hosea. Remember that chart I gave you? Crosses over a lot. They are the days of the Assyrians, and I just have some names there. Tiglath-Pileser and his dates, Shalmaneser, Sargon, Sennacherib. And so probably he was living through those four kings, and they were great, great kings of the Assyrians in the land of Nineveh. The theme is salvation is of the Lord. And the message, the first 39 chapters is a message of condemnation. First chapter 1 through 12, Judah is condemned for its alliances with Assyria. In chapter 13 through 27, the nations are condemned. He just goes through the litany of the nations. Remember, I said that last week. So many of these prophets will just go through Egypt, Philistia, and Moab, and Ammon, and Edom, and all that, and they'll go through them and condemn them. And so the nations are condemned for opposition to Israel as a nation, Judah and Israel completely. So he will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. You don't want to mess around with Israel. Judah is then condemned again for its alliances with Egypt. Remember, he's going to talk about that. Jeremiah talks about it too because, you know, they're trusting in Egypt. And remember, he calls it a broken reed. He says, why are you leaning on a broken reed? You can only imagine how much that would hurt, you know. He says, you're trusting those Egyptians to save you, and it's not going to work against the Assyrians and later on the Babylonians. And then Hezekiah is condemned for his alliance with Babylon. Remember, he'll make that kind of foolish mistake and show the Babylonians all the things in the temple, you know, and say, here's all the stuff we got. It's like opening your safe and telling the crooks how much stuff you got. It's just, what are you thinking about here? But he thought it was going to work. And it's a message of condemnation. And there's another sense in which it's the whole book of Isaiah is saying, you're a child of God, and who do you trust? In chapter 1 through 39, it's saying, you can't trust human alliances. You can't trust the nations and all that. And so it's a message of condemnation primarily because, whereas the other prophets will kind of focus in on, you know, you are idolatrous and you're immoral and you're intoxicated and you're stealing land and all those things. He's going to do that. There's no question. We're going to see that in chapter 5. But it's more, you guys are trusting the wrong people. You're trusting Egypt and Assyria and Hezekiah is trusting Babylon there at the end. And what are you doing? So chapter 40 through 66, the second half, is considered the message of comfort. And there's comfort for several reasons. Number one, in chapter 40 through 48, there's the coming of Cyrus, which you'd have to read that to figure out why that would be a comfort to Judah, but it is. And redemption is promised. In chapter 49 through 57, there's a coming servant of the Lord. That's a great passage is about the servant of the Lord. Redemption is provided. And a lot of that in those chapters will be related to the first coming of Jesus Christ. And then finally, in chapter 58 through 66, it's the coming sovereign or Lord, or king, if you would, and redemption present. And he's going to kind of jump time to the second coming of Jesus Christ, when the king is actually in control and the king is really on the throne, although it would be mixed through the whole book. And the question is, who do you trust as a child of God? Well, don't trust alliances. Trust God, who's going to come in the nick of time. He's going to come at the right time and do his work. So just keep trusting him. Keep trusting him. The style of Isaiah, he's considered an evangelistic prophet. He's trying to spread what an evangelist does. When you share the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, you're going to have to talk to people about the good news, but before you can do that, or somewhere in the process, you've got to tell them the bad news. You guys are a bunch of sinners, and you're facing doom, and you cannot take care of it yourself, so your only hope is to turn to one who can. And so he's an evangelistic prophet in that sense. He's going to be a prophet of doom, but only because he has to tell them the reality and destruction, only because he has to, so they can turn to God and find their solution. It's considered by some to be clearer and more explicit than in any other Old Testament books, these messianic prophecies and the evangelistic thing. As I said, it's sometimes considered the Bible in miniature. So let's just think about it. There are some classic passages in it. I'd like you to turn to chapter 5. Chapter 5 and 6 obviously go together. In chapter 6, he says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up." You have the great call of Isaiah. And there is debate whether that call came first, but it gets recorded in chapter 6, or the events of chapter 1 through 5 happen, and then chapter 6 happens, because you have the call. How did he preach chapters 1 through 5 if he wasn't called? Well, we will never be able to answer that, but we don't need to, because that's not what was written. What is written, as you're reading it, as the message goes out to you and me, here's what God wants you to do. He wants you to read the first 5 chapters before you get to chapter 6. If he wanted you to know chapter 6 first, he would have put it number 1, all right? So sometimes historians take, especially divinely inspired historians who are trying to convey a message even in the Gospels, they'll take events and rearrange them chronologically to give the message across. So it may be that the call of Isaiah was before the first 5 chapters. I don't believe that personally, but some people believe that, and that might be fine. Well, here's what I do know. He wants you to read the first 5 chapters. And as you go through that, you end up in chapter 5. And in chapter 5, you have the classic chapter of the Messiah's hatred. And there are 6 practices that he or God detests. It's the woe, woe, woe. So you've been making your way through it. This is Isaiah the prophet, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, chapter 5, he's getting stronger and stronger. And finally, chapter 5 comes, and it's like, woe to you, and woe to you, and woe to you. Kind of can almost imagine that kind of a preacher going at it. So let's look at him. Chapter 5, verse 8. Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field. And he's just talking about they have this insatiable desire for possessions, and they want more and more houses. It's not like it's wrong to have one house connected to another house, a duplex is against God's will or something. That's not what he's talking about. They just want more and more, more fields, more houses, whatever. So it's materialism. They just want more. There's no contentment in this land. If you want to put on the side there of your note, the nose, there's no contentment. They just want more and more and more and more. If this sounds strangely familiar, let me know somewhere along the line. Number 2, verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may follow intoxicating drink. It goes on until the night when the wine inflames it, the heart and strength, you know, wine, woman, and song. So it's sensuality. There's no restraint. As you read verses 11 down through whatever, they're just like more wine, more women, more song, just fun, 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 pleasure, pleasure. Sensuality is a drive there, indulgence, if you would. He then will say, woe to them in verse 18, who draw iniquity with cords of vanity. You have this picture of this little kid with his cart behind him, all right? And he's got a rope on it, and he's pulling the cart, all right? Only what they are doing, they have it full of iniquity, and they're parading it. Look at us. And so he just uses the word iniquity, and he describes it a little bit. They just love to sin, and they parade it around. It's in their cart behind him with a little string on it, and they're walking down the street in their sin. I can't imagine any culture like that. Can you? Then you have verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Darkness light, light darkness. Sweet bitter and bitter sweet, you know. And there's just this injustice going on. They have no morality, if you would. If you want to put the nose there. No contentment, no restraint, no shame. And now no morals or morality. They got it all messed up. Good is evil, evil is good, bitter is sweet, sweet is bitter. They got it all messed up. And then he says, verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, prudent in their own sight. They're arrogant. They're self-centered. There's no sense of humility or no respect for authority or something like that. They're just proud people, arrogant people. And finally, in verse 22, woe to men mighty at drinking wine, valiant for mixing. You have to read the whole thing. And they take away justice from the righteous men. They're just insolent. They have addictions and corruptions, and they have no sense of obligation for what's right in their life. And they just are a wicked, wicked people. And chapter 5 is a crucial chapter in the whole message. And he comes down as about as hard as you can come on people. By the way, as you list those, and you will find that list of 5 or 6 or 7 things repeated in Scripture again and again. You know, indulgence, immorality, idolatry, intoxication, those words, I didn't use all of them there, materialism, you know, sensuality, whatever comes up like that. Jackie, did you have a question? Got it? Okay, good. So by chapter 5, you're like, man, are these a bunch of bad people, right? And you're just like, go get them, Isaiah. Point that finger at them and let them have it, you know? We need more preachers like that in our town, you know? And you're really, really moved by it. And he's right. What he is doing is exactly right. So there's no question about that. We come to chapter 6, and suddenly, that's why I think the chronology, I could never prove it one way or another, but God wants you to read it this way. You have entered into it. You're with Isaiah and go, Isaiah, get them. Go get those bad, bad people. I can't believe a culture and a nation like that. And then you have this great, great chapter. You've all read it. Isaiah 6 is, you know, one of the great, great chapters. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled his temple. And above it stood seraphim, and each one had 6 wings. And with 2 he covered his face, 2 he covered his feet, 2 he covered, and with 2 he flew. And the one would cry out to the other and say, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, what's his next word? Well, who? Woe is me. And it just hits you. Yeah, you just were like, go get him, boy. Whoa, 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 you're intoxicated, you're immoral, and all of a sudden he goes, woe is me, for I am undone. And I dwell, and I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the Lord, the King, the Lord of hosts. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips, your iniquity is taken away, and your sins are purged. And then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, send me. And he said, go and tell this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on perceiving, and do not perceive. I said, Lord, how long? He said, until the cities are destroyed and have no inhabitants. And the houses are without a man. The land is utterly destroyed, and the Lord has removed men from far away. If you read that, you recognize chapter 6 is, if chapter 5 is about, here's what the Messiah hates. God hates all these bad, bad things, all right? In chapter 6, it's all about the Messiah's motivation to ministry. And Isaiah was going to preach a long time, at least 40 years, probably, I think, 60 years. That's a long time to preach to a nation that's not listening. And he needed this call in his life to be motivated to minister, to keep going for 60 years or 50 or whatever it might be. You recognize verses 1 through 4. He realized the glory of God, the greatness of God. Whatever word you want to put in there, he saw the Lord. He saw him with all of his authority and all of his glory and all of his power. You know, the king, the greatest king in his whole life, he was a young man probably, then if he would preach 60 years after that, he was probably a pretty young man. The king who was his hero, the hero of all the people, just died. How will we go on? But the King of Kings is alive and well, sitting on the throne. And he saw the greatness, the holiness, the glory, all those words, whatever words you want to use there of God. And he never forgot that. As you read through the book of Isaiah, he would just always come back to that. The Holy One of Israel. He's the one who keeps saying, now the Holy One of Israel. Now the Holy One of Israel. By the way, the word holy, as we have discussed several times, does not mean righteous, does it? A holy God is a righteous God. But the word holy means to be set apart and distinct and different. There is none like Him. There's none like Him when it comes to righteousness. There's none like Him when it comes to faithfulness. There's none like Him when it comes to love. There's none like Him when it comes to whatever characteristic He has. He's, you know, whatever you and I have ever seen in any other people, it doesn't even begin to compare. There's none like Him. And He just saw the holiness of God. There was none like Him. And He just said, wow, I saw the King, the Lord. So He saw the glory of God, and that motivated the ministry. He serves a living and glorious and powerful and holy and all those things God. But immediately He said in verse 5, woe is me. He had to realize the sinfulness of Himself. And it's like God knew exactly how to put this book together. Because about the time we're all going, yeah, woe to you. I know somebody down my street. He's immoral, intoxicated, you know, steals, rah, 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 you know. All of a sudden Isaiah, in the presence of God, forgot about everybody else. And he realized the sinfulness of himself. And he never forgot that. As you read the rest of the book, he was a great preacher of condemnation and comfort. Not only because he saw the glory of God, because he knew he was nothing. He knew he was as sinful as the rest, and that's what he says here. I am undone. You ever get undone? I used to get undone when I was a kid. You know, don't touch the cookies, they're cooling. Mom's not looking. Cookie. You know, she'd walk in, hand on the cookies. I'm undone. You know, that's what it means. You're caught red-handed. You're done, man. And he knew it. On his own, he had no hope himself. All the woes. Remember when you do this? What? How many fingers are pointing at you? How many fingers pointing at me? You know. I'm undone. I have unclean lips. Wow. And I dwell in the midst of a people with unclean lips. So we have to realize that the second motivation of ministry is the sinfulness of ourselves. Just we are nothing, and that sinfulness is taken care of right there. A sinfulness that is present, but a sinfulness that can be taken care of by the altar. There, that's the altar of the sacrifices for sin. So it's all not just symbolic; it's very real. You know, God sees your sin, but God can take care of your sin, Isaiah. And so he never forgot that. Never forgot the holiness of God. Never caught the sinfulness of men. And throughout his preaching, he never forgot that he had been pardoned. That God, and that's his message. Hey, I was a really bad guy too once, you know. And God totally forgave me my sins. And I had unclean lips, and I was undone. And one day God stepped into my life, and he forgave me. And God could do that for you. That's his message. And the last part of it, he hears the voice of the Lord, and you got to love that part. Because it helps you to understand, whom shall I send? It's like God is sitting over here talking to himself, the Trinity. So, you know, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? You know, and Isaiah's like, what do you mean? I'll go. You know, the thing you love about it. Here's what you love about it. Here's what we do. Well, where do you want me to go? Well, how long will it be? We have all these conditions, you know. I have to know all the facts, God. He's like, I'll go. I'll go, I'll go, I'll go. He doesn't know where it is, how long it is, what he's supposed to do. He's just wanting, if you need somebody, I'll do it. These are the marks of ministry. You have to realize the marks of ministry. You have to surrender unconditionally with no conditions. Like, I'll do it as long as it's in the right place, at the right way, and the right people, and the right, you know, I'm good at it, and all that stuff. It involves surrender. It involves sending. God says, I'll send you. That means I'll take care of it. I don't know if you've ever been in foreign countries, but there's a difference between the way missionaries live and the embassy of the United States people live. It's like night, day, you know. Missionaries live on whatever amount of dollars a year. And they're never complaining. They're all happy and they're doing well, right? Then you watch the embassy workers. They're sent by the United States. They'll drive, you know, Tahoes and Durangos in countries that don't have cars, you know. Air conditioned, swimming pools, they send their kids to the best school, and if there isn't a best school there, the government puts in a best school. And they're well taken care of. And I don't deny them that at all. You know, some of them live in some pretty tough places. I remember when we were in Africa, I mean, like, we were eating peanut butter and jam, and we went to the embassy once, and it was like, they're driving Chevy Suburbans. They have their own pool. They have an air-conditioned house. They have television that they can bring in. They, you know, their kids are eating Cheerios, and we couldn't get, you know, whatever. It's like, you guys got it good, you know, because they were sent by the United States, and the United States takes care of you. We don't send people out and then say, I hope you make it, buddy. And Isaiah had to know that. God sends you out. I'll send you. I'll take care of you. It involves, as you read that, he goes on, what do you want me to do? He says, go and tell this people. It involves speaking. And as you read about those people in verse 9, 10, you know, keep on hearing, do not understand, keep on seeing, but do not perceive. That's written like almost God hopes that they don't listen. No, it's written in a Hebrew way of saying this. Here's what's going to happen, Isaiah. You're going to preach your heart out, and nobody's going to listen. I'm just going to tell you up front. You're going to do this for 60 years. You're going to keep preaching, preaching, preaching. God is holy. Man is sinful. There's no hope. You need to turn to a Savior. And they're going to be, I don't hear you. I don't see you. They're just not going to get it. They're going to be dull of hearing. So Isaiah says, well, how long? And our answer is, you've got to tell them at least twice, then you feel free, right? And God says, here's how long you're going to do it. You're going to do it until everything's gone. There's no more men around. You're going to preach till the cities are destroyed and every man is gone. In other words, God is saying, here's the marks of ministry. It involves surrender and sending. It involves speaking, even if people don't listen. It involves staying, even if nobody ever turns to you or to God. You just keep preaching. You know why? God always wants His message going out. And we cannot say, you know, not too many people are listening anymore, so I'm going to pick up shop, get out of here. No one likes it anyway. God says, no, I always want a message going out. Now, in the midst of that, when you get really discouraged, you say, oh, poor Isaiah. You know, at the end in verse 13, but a tenth will be in it. And you could read that account. He says, you know, nobody's going to listen. Oh, by the way, some will. It'll be a small number, my friend. It'll be a little remnant. But I will always bring out the message so that everybody has an opportunity, and because some are going to respond. And those are the marks of ministry. So chapter 6 is crucial to the whole message. The Messiah's motivation to ministry. Realize the glory of God, the sinfulness of self, and the marks of ministry. You've got to get it down. And like I said, Isaiah never forgot those things. He'll just pick it up again and again. He'll preach about the holiness of God, the sinfulness of man, the glory of God, and the need for repentance, and on it goes. Great, great chapter. You can't help but love that one. Having done that, he gets into some other ones. These are just some classic passages. Chapter 7, verse 14, the Messiah's entry. You remember in chapter 7 and verse 14, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, or God with us. Remember, Ahaz was king now. So we move down chronologically. Ahaz was not a good king. He was a bad king. And Isaiah had to go to preach to bad guys like that, you know. And he's preaching to him. And God says to Ahaz, Ahaz, you ask any sign you want, and I will give it to you to prove to you that what I'm saying through Isaiah is true. Just ask a sign. You don't seem to listen to him. You don't seem to believe him. You ask a sign, I'll give it to you. He said, I don't want one. So Ahaz refuses to get a sign. He refuses to say, this is what I'd like. You just, you know, do this. Do something spectacular. I'll believe him. That is how hard Ahaz was. He didn't want to hear. So God says, I'll give you a sign. And here it is in verse 14. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and he shall call his name Emmanuel. And there is a sense in which, remember we had the double fulfillment or the partial and the ultimate fulfillment? There was a sense in which that would happen in Ahaz's life, but not in the full sense. It will ultimately be fulfilled in who? Who will be born of the Virgin? Christ, Emmanuel. And that would be the ultimate fulfillment, although partially it was fulfilled in the day of Ahaz, as you would read that chapter. So that's a great one. By the way, you just have to know, as you study that, there will be a great debate, or there's a problem of Alma. Alma is the word that's translated virgin. And if you look at that word in other places, the Hebrew word Alma, many people will make the case that it means a young woman. And therefore, it isn't a virgin, all right? And so there wasn't a virgin birth, and Christ was born not from virgin birth. And you can't prove from Isaiah 7, verse 14, and whatever. And we, in almost every translation I've ever seen, it is used the word virgin. You just have to know that debate exists out there. The liberals tend to strive very hard to prove to you that it was a young woman. But and I don't have time tonight. I think I could make my case that it's virgin. But anyway, just know the issue is out there. Even if that were young woman, by the way, in their thinking and in their mind, young women were virgins, by the way. So that's still not a problem for us. And secondly, if you go to the New Testament, it's pretty clear there. So I don't need Isaiah 7, verse 14 to prove to me the virgin birth of Christ, although I think you can prove Alma can be and should be translated virgin in that case. In Isaiah 9, you have another classic, Messiah's birth. And in chapter 9, it's a great, great chapter. Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed. And the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali is repeated in the Gospels, of course. In Galilee of Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Remember when Christ was walking there, it's quoted in the New Testament, that a fulfillment of it. And it will be a day that brings great revelation and great light. Those who walked in darkness, all of a sudden they saw a great light. That'll be a great, great day when the Messiah is here. In chapter 9, verse 3 through 5, they rejoice. They increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of the harvest. As men rejoice when they, and he just uses the word rejoice, and it's all about, it'll be a day of great rejoicing. So when the Messiah comes, it'll be a day of great revelation and light. It'll be a day of great rejoicing and victory. And then verse 6 and 7 of chapter 9, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders. His name will be called. You know, this is that classic, classic verse. Of the increase of his government and peace will be no end, et cetera, et cetera. It will be a day that brings a great ruler, a great leader. And the government will be on his shoulder. And on it goes. So there's a passage on the Messiah's birth or coming and gives him great hope. So even though some people say the first 39 chapters all about condemnation, scattered through it will be some great, great statements of that are very positive. In fact, in chapter 11, the next classic passage is the Messiah's prince or ruler. And as you read through that, the branch shall grow out of its roots, talking about the stem of Jesse. And as you read through it, and we won't put anything down here, but he says, the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, Spirit of wisdom, understanding, counsel, and wisdom, knowledge. His delight is in the fear of the Lord. You go down to that great passage, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the young goat, the calf with the young lion, the child shall lead them, the cow and the bear shall graze together, the little ones will lie down together, and on a, you know, that great, when the ruler comes, the messianic ruler comes, there will be a great, great day. Part of it, just the natural world, will be different than anything we've ever seen, with lions and lambs laying down together, and little kids will reach their whole hand in the hole of the aspen, and they won't be bitten. But the other part of it, the lead of this ruler, who have the Spirit of the Lord upon him, and there's just a whole passage there. It's more than just the natural world has changed. Many, many other things. Just some other ones, quickly. Isaiah 26:3. Remember that one? Who can sing it for me or say it to me? Our church, when we... Yeah. Pardon me? Yeah. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on on thee, for he trusts in thee. All right? The church that I was baptized in and was raised in for a short period of time as a college student when I was first saved and my life was really getting together there. At the end of the service, we automatically sang that song. I mean, when he got done praying and preaching, he said amen, and he prayed. You know, we automatically, for all the time was there. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee because he trusts in thee, and then we all walk out. It's a great, great passage, the Messiah's peace. This Messiah that we're going to talk about, and you could read that through this book, will bring peace, a perfect peace, a peace that the world doesn't understand. By the way, the word is really shalom. So it helped me to understand the shalom. When we think of peace, it means we're not shooting at each other, right? We're not taking our fists and hitting each other. We're not shooting guns at each other. Shalom is a little bit bigger than that. What does that mean? Pardon me? Complete harmony, all right? Remember what Yuval said, Myrna? Yeah. And he really helped me because I know that it's translated welfare in Nehemiah. The last word of Nehemiah is welfare, which means faring well. And that's what it means, to fare well. All right? And Yuval then put it together for me. He says it's a completed circle. It's complete. It's all there. You know, it's not three-quarters of a circle or seven-eighths or half or whatever. And so for a Jew to say shalom, what we would translate peace, what he's saying is, he's not just saying, I hope you don't have a fight today. He's saying, I hope your life, or my goal for you would be that your life would be complete, that there would be harmony, there would be fullness, you'd fare well. It'd be all that it's supposed to be. And so it's a very... It's a very significant word. And so shalom, which we kind of use like, oh, I hope you don't have a fight, really means so much more. And it's really what we really want. God's shalom, you know, that we're faring well by all of his standards. That doesn't mean you don't have bad days and suffer, Job did and whatever, but you still can have a full life. You can have a shalom in your life. So the Messiah's peace. Isaiah 40, verse 31, the Messiah's promise. They that wait on the Lord, go ahead, Bethany, quote it for me. Right? Yep. Absolutely. Great, great passage. Many of us have studied that. They that wait on the Lord, you know. So it's trusting the Lord, Isaiah 26, verse 3, brings peace. Waiting on the Lord and allows you to run and walk and not be weary. And you could dissect that whole verse. Chapter 41. Especially verse 10, but throughout the book, or that chapter, it's the Messiah's promise. And he will keep saying, oh, I don't know how many times, chapter 41, verse 10, fear not. Chapter 41, verse 13, fear not. Chapter 41, verse 14, fear not. Again and again he would say, fear not, fear not, fear not, fear not, you know. And remember, this is the second half, this message will come, now fear not, fear not, fear not. And he will say, I am with you. God is speaking to the children of Israel. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. Yes, I will hold you with my righteous right hand. And so the child of God who's struggling in the days of Isaiah, as he's watching his country go from Uzziah to Jotham to Ahaz, a bad guy, back to Hezekiah, and they're all over the charts. And Israel goes up in smoke to the north, and you know they weren't ever supposed to collapse, and they collapse. And the same people, the Assyrians who were attacking Israel, then moved down, and were going to take Judah. By God's grace, and because he had a promise to Judah, he pushed them out. They eventually were destroyed. And then the Babylonians came in a long, long time later. But they don't know that, you know. The same guys who just took Samaria and in Israel, they're knocking on our door and they are attacking. And we had a bad king named Ahaz, and, you know. And all of a sudden Isaiah says, wait a minute, fear not. God says, I'll be with you. Be not dismayed. I will hold you with my righteous right hand. And it's a great promise, the Messiah's promise, or presence, I should say, in chapter 41. And then the Messiah's provision in chapter 55 and verse 1. And he's building his case. And, you know, as you go through this book, he just makes a tremendous case all the way through it. And finally, in 55 verse 1, that great passage, ho, everyone at thirst, come to the waters and you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Yes, come, buy wine and milk with money and without money and without price. And he just says, come, come. And he has provision. You don't need to have money. The Messiah has provision for you. And you can be a part of this kingdom. You can be a part of the program of God. And not only find his peace, his promise, his presence, you can find his provision. And it's not dependent upon what you have to bring. You don't need your money. You don't need your goodness. you can just depend upon Him. And that's why it ends, this great book ends, driving you to an expectation that there's salvation, there's good news, even in the midst of bad times and bad people, including yourself as a bad person, that there's good news. And anybody who thirsts, just come, and you have all that you need. So those are just some of the classic passages. There are many others I could have put down there that are wonderful. Isaiah 35, you love Isaiah 35. Isaiah 61, I think, where it talks about the Messianic kingdom. You're just kind of like, oh man, I wish I could live there. It's kind of like the Garden of Eden, you know? Well, someday we will. Any comments on those? Let me quickly just do this next page. And I know there's a tremendous amount. Isaiah, you cannot study Isaiah without focusing at some point on the anonymous servant. It is part of that concept, the anonymous servant. He just talked about the servant of the Lord. He never tells us his name, although we're smart enough to know who it is. All right, it's part of four servant passages, and they're listed there. Chapter 42, 49, 50, and 52 through 53. You got the verses there. In 42, the servant is chosen, gifted, effective. Chapter 49, the servant is rejected, but he's the light of the world. In chapter 50, the servant is rejected, but in that he learns to minister to the rejected. And then that classic one, which we're going to lay out here, chapter 52, verse 13 to chapter 53 at the end, the servant is rejected but fulfills his role. As you look at that one, chapter 52, verse 13, this is the one, but he was wounded for our transgression, bruised for our iniquities, and chastisement. You know, who has believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? As you read that, it is in the form of five strophes. Now, some of you are grammarians and poets and all that, but most of us don't know what a strophe is, but it means a poetic section. Okay, of three verses each. And we will see it broken down there, those five sections. Chapter 52, verse 12. I'm sorry, verse 13, it should be, through 15. Chapter 53, 1 through 3, and then 4 through 6, and 7 through 9. And it's just a tremendous poetic section. Okay, it's by Isaiah. Here's the trick of this one, where he talks about, who has believed my report? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, a root out of a dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness. So when we see him, there's no beauty that we should behold him, etc., etc. But he was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquities, etc., etc. You've all read that. You have to do this. You have to realize that it's written by Isaiah. So that's in the past, right? Somewhere back 700 or somewhere. He wrote it in the past. It's about Israel in the future. Or Israel's reaction in the end days. Someday, he says, so this guy standing way back here in time is talking about someday in the future, Israel is going to say this. They're going to say, who has believed our report? But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The hour there. And there's pronouns going on in this. God will speak and then Israel will speak. And that's Israel in the end days will look back and say, we missed it. We blew it. Who would have believed his report? He grew up before us like a tender plant, like a root out of a dry ground. He had no form nor comeliness, and there was no beauty that we would desire him. And then all of a sudden, now we realize he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, etc., etc. So you got Isaiah in the past writing it about a day when Israel in the future will look back on the Lord Jesus Christ at his first coming. And so that's the third part. To what they had done to Christ, namely as a nation on the cross. So you got three times, if you would, going on. And if you can catch that, you get it. If you can't catch that, you're going to struggle with this in some ways. Okay. Let me just lay out the strokes, I would say. Chapter 52, verse 13 through 15, a startling revelation of a servant's exaltation. Behold, my servant shall do prudently. He shall be exalted. You know, God is speaking there. And it's like, just as many were astonished at you, his visage was marred more than any man, his form more than the sons of men. And it's just like the startling revelation of his approval by God the Father, his astonishment to the people and the accomplishments that he would do. And it sets the tone for it. So that's that first part, startling revelation. Then, chapter 53, verses 1 through 3, a sorrowful rejection. Because of character. to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grows up before him as a tender plant, a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, that when we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. He's despised and rejected of men, a man of grief and acquainted with grief. And he said, Israel is saying, you know, when he came, he didn't look right. We expected the Messiah, and then this guy came by the name of Jesus. And who could have believed it? He was like a root out of a dry ground. You ever see a root out of a dry ground? What are the chances of that thing growing? None. We looked at this person named Jesus and we said that's a root out of a dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness. He didn't look right. He was despised and rejected of men. People weren't saying, yes, he's the king. Especially the religious leader and the political leaders of Israel are not accepting him. And everything about him was wrong. He didn't come and he didn't look and he didn't do what we expected him to do. We expected the Messiah to set up the kingdom and we thought of whatever that was. And he didn't do it. There was no beauty about him. He didn't win the, most likely to succeed in the yearbook award. He wasn't the king of the class or queen or everything about him was wrong. His arm wasn't the arm we expected. His ancestry, his appearance, his acceptance, his social, none of it was what we expected. We missed it. We blew it. Verse 4, 5, and 6 is a great center of it. Surely he has borne our griefs. It just like takes a change. It's like he was despised and we put no value on him. But surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And there's this substitutionary redemption for the atonement. And you've all quoted those verses many, many times. By the way, this is a powerful passage you're witnessing. I remember an older man in our first church, down the road from our church, who never once came to our church. And I went and visited him for various reasons. And eventually, he was a hard, ungodly, hated God man. But he liked me. So he had a home that wasn't the best looking home and whatever. But I would go there and his wife was sick and was in the hospital often. And sometimes they would let me eat with him. And I remember the day, I tried to witness to him. I would witness to him. And he had nothing. He never wanted to go to church. Didn't want anything to do with God, whatever. One day he was in the hospital. It wasn't his wife. It was him. And I just read Isaiah 53. And when I looked up, he was weeping like a baby. It is a powerful passage. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. And all I did was read it, So just read it to people. Substitutionary redemption. The last verses, or the second to the last strophe, of submissive resignation. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is dumb. This submissive resignation. It was inhuman treatment. It was illegal trial. And intended to him. It just lays out the life of Jesus Christ there. And then the satisfying reward in verse 10 down through verse 12, it like changes again. Yet, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. In other words, the Lord was in charge of that. God was in charge. And it pleased the Lord to bruise him, etc., etc. He made his grave with the wicked. But in the rich, in his death, everything changed. They got to a point and all of a sudden everything changed. So, you can see the flow. Again, as you can see it laid out here, it's chiasmus, and we've talked about that a little bit. The center of it all is verse 4, 5, and 6, which most of us have memorized. He was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement that was necessary for our peace was laid on him, and by his stripes we are healed. That's the center. Everything turns on that. So everything goes to that. Everything comes away from that. And you can't study Isaiah without Isaiah 53. So that's Isaiah. That's in a nutshell, going fast. Reward. This one who was so abused and everything else, in the end, had his grave with the rich. And then he will talk about the resurrection. It actually talks about the resurrection. So, and we know that was true of Christ. It was going downhill fast, and he was crucified, and they were ready to do damage to him, and they came, and his bones were, he was dead already. They didn't have to break his bones, and they were going to put him in this criminal's grave, and they got thrown into one of the best graves in town, and from that moment on, God rewarded him. Everything was uphill for him. Okay? Any other questions or comments on Isaiah? So you got to get that. Isaiah, it hadn't happened yet. You know, he's prophesying something that's going to happen in the future, and he's actually telling us about the day when Israel will look back and know what they did to Christ on the cross. And so that's the key to it all. It's a prophecy of what would happen and what Israel will one day figure out they did. One day Israel's eyes will be open, and they will see Christ for who he really was. And they will say, we blew it. Did we blow it or what? Okay, take a break, 5 minutes or so, and we'll try to do Micah and Nahum.